All right, well, let's continue on with our second speaker this afternoon, Professor Will Wimsatt, who is currently the Winton Chair in the Philosophy Department at the University of Minnesota. He's also an affiliate member of our sister institution there, the Center for Philosophy of Science at Minnesota. He's also Professor Emeritus in Philosophy in the Committee on Evolutionary Biology at the University of Chicago, where he was before moving to Minnesota. He is the author of a wonderful book called Reengineering Philosophy for Limited Beings, which is a great motto. He does research on what he calls the philosophy of the inexact sciences, which is pretty much everything else. Well, we saw it as physics too.
Including a lot of physics. Right?
That's right, including a lot of physics, good. And he works on the study of complex systems. So he'll be speaking to us today on the topic of resources and challenges for multi-scale modeling in biological systems. Please join me in welcoming Bill Wimsatt.
Eliza, thank you very much for inviting me here. It's a real pleasure. I actually was here once,
65 years ago.
In 1970. It's been a long time.
And that would be Bob Cohn who invited you, who was the founder and director
of the center
here.
Yeah.
Been coming for 57 years.
I hope we get a chance to talk later. Yeah. So, what I'll say will be a good deal less rigorous and carefully elaborated than our previous one. Biology is a lot messier. There is a simulation in there in which simulations at a lower level indicate the presence of higher level factors. But most of the time I'll spend talking about why methods that may work for multiple realizability in physics, say things like renormalization and so on, undoubtedly they're present in biology, but there are other factors, other sources of robust properties and things like that, and we need to understand how that is possible. So,
I'll also be talking about at least one physics example, but using that just to illustrate what happens when you have a multiplicity of boundary conditions in a temporally developing process. So we'll go on from there. So in thinking about relations between levels of organization, I owe a great deal to mathematical ecologist and social theorist and activist Richard Levins. For stimulating my thoughts about complexity, aggregativity, and emergence. Levins died here just at the beginning of this year, and he was a major theoretician of complex systems. Enter Bob Batterman for multiple interactions over the years over multiple realizability and intersections between physics and biology. So this talk is a work in progress and dedicated to the memory of Richard Levins. First, I'll talk about aggregativity and emergence, drawing on a distinction among types of complexity advanced by Richard Levins, and examples draw from both physics and biology. Then I consider some of the differences between physics and biology in this respect, between the three classes of systems, and why I would expect that multi-scale modeling will be more varied and difficult in biology. Robustness is widespread in biological organization. It's a product of selection, but arises in different ways in multiple realizability in physics. And a new process, generative entrenchment, emerges in biology and the evolution of technology. It's generic to adaptive systems subject to selection. Finally, I'll say something about levels of organization, which, if I get to it, which are ubiquitous in both physical and biological realms. So multi-scale modeling has become a hot new topic in philosophy of science, largely because of the work on renormalization in condensed matter physics, and increasing moves in philosophy of physics away from the focus on so-called fundamental theory and towards the fascinating variety of phenomena and methods embraced by material science and condensed matter physics. And it's about time. According to Leo Kadanoff, over 90% of the members of the American Physical Society are condensed matter physicists. You'd never discover this from philosophers. These have implications for explanation of higher level phenomena that are multiply realizable and for the importance of organizational features at higher levels acting as boundary conditions in the explanation of phenomena at all levels. Now, emergence and the need for higher level theory has been pursued in basically two kinds of contexts. Most of the work in physics has jumped off from cases of what I'll call homogeneous emergence, in which the system is composed of similar parts and there's a kind of mass action producing the emergent behavior. Biology has this kind of emergence, but also another kind common in engineering contexts in which dissimilar parts and interactions between them produce behavior not found for any of the parts in isolation. And biology has still other complexities. I'll begin with a classification of types of systems advanced by Richard Levins. Let's revise it to talk about types of properties of complex systems, since complex systems have properties of all three types. Each of them bears on relations between levels. So this is Levins' classification from a paper on complex systems, which was actually... it was a tape recording of a talk, conversation Richard Gregory was having with Dick Levins at the Waddington volumes of Waddington conferences on theoretical biology at Via Serbelloni. And someone said one of the amazing things about Levins is he talks spontaneously in whole paragraphs. Yeah, you have a question.
Yeah, would you mind just recapping? You did homogeneous and heterogeneous, and then there was a third.
I'm sorry?
You mentioned homogeneous systems, heterogeneous systems, and then there was a third system.
No, I'm going to talk about... that's different from the classification I'm going to give now.
Okay.
Of complexity, of complex systems. So the first is the aggregate system, in which the properties of the whole are statistics of the properties of individual parts. The properties enter as parts of a mean or variance in which the parts are therefore affecting the properties of the whole in the same way and not directly acting on each other in the model. Now, there may be physical interactions in this, but it's simply irrelevant for some kinds of problems. There are many cases in which phenomena appear to be scale invariant or nearly so, as we see in the next slide. Here's an indication of properties that are aggregative. Any guesses on what scale that is? Is it taken on a flight across the country and say maybe a feature that's about a mile in size or much smaller? Any guesses?
Small. Yeah,
small. It's true. That's a wave action on a local beach. But the point is, you could easily see this kind of thing flying across country. And the fact that you can get the same kinds of configurations at radically different sizes is an indication of a kind of scale invariance of certain physical forces, in this case, gravity. After the aggregate system, consider a composed system, this is the second type, such as an engineer's circuit. The ways in which different kinds of parts are strung together will determine system properties, which therefore are no longer derivable from simple statistics of the components. This is a composed system because the properties of the parts can be completely specified by study in isolation. They don't affect the mode of response of each other, but only the way that a signal is processed passing through all of them. So here's my paradigm of a composed system. An Erector set provides a paradigm for an engineered system. Its many standardized parts can be put together in multiple different ways to make a large diversity of systems. This is also important, by the way, in technology and in biology. The combinatorial explosion of standardized parts fueled the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century, as Sears catalogs and hardware stores replaced blacksmith shops. And what's crucial about those is you, in the Sears catalog and the hardware store, you use off-the-shelf elements to build something. The blacksmith shop, everything is custom built to order. A third kind of system no longer permits this kind of analysis. This is a kind of system in which the component subsystems have evolved together and are not even obviously separable, in which it may be conceptually difficult to decide what are the really relevant component subsystems. Now, one reason an evolved system can be such a mess to analyze is not that it doesn't have parts boundaries, but that it has multiple different overlapping parts boundaries relevant for different purposes. Thus, a physiological individual of a sexual species must form a mating pair to be an evolutionarily significant unit. But you see much more of this going on inside, and I'll have a picture later. The situation is worse than that, however. The very nature of selection as opportunistically co-opting pre-existing elements with other functions for new purposes also is a contributing factor. By the way, in co-opting them for new purposes, it's making them members also of another overlapping functional network. This process is common in software design, and I found this lovely quote by Brian Foote and Joseph Yoder at the University of Illinois Department of Computer Science, talking about problems arising in software engineering. A big ball of mud is haphazardly structured, sprawling, sloppy, duct tape and baling wire, spaghetti code jungle. We've all seen them. These systems show unmistakable signs of unregulated growth and repeated expedient repair. Information is shared promiscuously among distinct elements of the system, often to the point where nearly all of the important information becomes global or duplicated. The overall structure of the system may never have been well defined. If it was, it may have eroded beyond recognition. This is, say, Microsoft Word or IBM operating system or whatever. Okay. Now, if evolution proceeds through a series of contextually advantageous layered kludges, how is it different? And how do we escape its consequences for having an unmanageable mess? Sadly, while there's a means of escape for biological evolution, which I'll talk about later, it's not available to software programmers. This, as well as a generation of robustness in biology and modularity of quasi-independent elements allowing evolution, all likely have a common cause, at least in sexual species, in the operation of recombination. In such systems, functional organization remains relatively stable, not because it's physically generic, which would be the line looking out at physics, but through the action of generative entrenchment. I'll return to this below. Return now to a contrast that most obviously relates to aggregative and engineered properties. These are variations on an Aristotelian theme, that is, emergence is the whole is more than the sum of its parts. Aristotle contrasted a heap of stones with an emergent entity. So he says a heap of stones is a mere aggregate. Now, we have to look at this and say in one respect. We always think about, well, counting it, it forms an aggregate of its numbers, or weighing it is to form an aggregate of its masses. But its shape depends on how they're arranged, and so does its stability. It's a pile. So this suggests a strategy for thinking about emergence as non-aggregativity, it's what I'll call the Erector set criterion, which I'll return to in the next slide. The Erector set criterion for emergence. A system property is emergent if it depends on the mode of organization of its parts. What you build depends on how you put it together. So this is basically saying there's lots of emergence in Levin's second kind of system, the composed or engineered system, which, by the way, you might have totally reductionistic explanations for all of its behavior. But the point is, their behavior of the system, which are not found for any of its parts properties. But how do you classify different possible modes of organization of the parts? That if we just say it's all emergent, that's not very informative. We'd like to be able to get some teeth in the distinction. And I actually laid out four criteria and how they classify a number of different cases in the handout. It seems like there are arbitrarily many ways of classifying different possible modes of organization in the part, and no way of ordering them. So let's turn around the question around. What is it for a system property to be just an aggregate, nothing more than the sum of the parts? Now, there turns out there are four different criteria for aggregativity, giving 15 different ways for one or more of these properties to fail to be met. Each is a different way that a system property can depend on how parts are organized. So let's look at them. A system property is an aggregate of parts properties. Note, this is relative to a choice of property and a choice of decomposition. That is, this may not be true for different decomposition or for different properties. If and only if, one, we have the denial of the erector set criteria. Rearrangements of parts makes no difference to the system property. That's the sort of most obvious one. Secondly, what I'll call the wearing blender criteria. Blending, disruption, and reaggregation doesn't make a difference. Applies criterion one to parts on all size scales. I have to tell a little joke here. Jack Cowan, a theoretical biologist at Chicago, was called in by the president, who said to him, theoretical biologists, use a lot of mathematics and physics to explain the behavior of organisms, and so do biophysicists. So you must be doing the same thing. And Jack said, now I'll tell you what. The difference between a biophysicist and a theoretical biologist is take a rat and drop it into a wearing blender. The biophysicist is interested in what properties are invariant under that transformation. So the president didn't understand and merged the two departments. So third, there shouldn't be any cooperative or inhibitory interactions among the parts. And fourth, size scaling. Adding or subtracting parts produces an appropriately proportional change. Now note that all of these can be made degree properties, so we have degrees of aggregativity, by talking about invariants of the system property within specified tolerances or limits. So you can actually have a fairly rich set of tools for classifying kinds of emergence by poking, by looking at which kind of property is not met, or if it's met in degrees, maybe the limits within which it's met, or met within an epsilon, and so on. Okay. Now, something can be a homogeneous collection of like entities and still not act as an aggregate. The phenomenon of critical mass in a fissionable material is a good example. In this case, a configuration-dependent threshold property. That is, people always talk about critical mass, but they really mean spherically configured critical mass at reasonable pressures. Of course, atomic bombs work by exploding a charge around it and compressing it and turning a subcritical mass into a critical mass. And so also if you string it out into a wire, you turn a critical mass into a non-critical mass. Okay. Critical mass has multiple analogs in biology and in the human sciences. A lot of work in human cultural evolution worries about whether or not you have a large enough population so that you don't lose innovations and you can transmit them from generation to generation. But there are also less obvious kinds of interactions among entities where their behavior depends on thresholds. The preceding classification of forms of emergence is static. The next case will involve violation of criterion 3 and 4 of aggregativity revealed in a dynamical context. Truncation selection with multilocus genomes, where everything below a certain threshold fitness level is selected out, acting on a purely additive model of fitness, can generate unusual behavior when the fitness contributions, though additive, can be of different sizes. In additive models where the contributions are all the same size, the direction of change is monotonic, and there are no reversals of direction in the frequency trajectories. Not so for additive fitness models with different size fitness contribution of different alleles. And these are from simulations we did 25 years ago, taking 2,500 hours on a Mac 2 computer. You could probably do it in your iPhone if you could code it in 2 hours. I want to talk about truncation selection. Truncation selection is not included in all evolutionary models, but it's probably the general case. In a multi-locus genome, which has all sorts of lethals and all sorts of conditional sublethals, you have an organism or complex machine. It's like an iceberg. For you to see anything above water, that is anything surviving or doing something, another 90% below buoys it up. Similarly, for an organism to survive, many systems have to work to sustain it. An organism has zero fitness if you start knocking out genes with mutations, long before you knock out all of its genes. So we have to distinguish fitness from what I'll call exposure. You could think of that as the sum of fitness losses if you knock out each gene and add them all up. And truncation selection would be expected to be the general case. Truncation selection models are not uncommon, especially in quantitative genetics. But existing ones assume that all genes contribute equal fitness increments. If we have multiple different fitness classes, as here, we see new behavior not found in the standard models. And what happens because as you lose fitness, something that is a fairly small contribution, as you get close to just making it, may be dying or not. And so, in effect, you have fitness amplification. So this is rescaling of relative fitness. When mean fitness is reduced, that's from mutational loss of adaptive loci, if the contribution of an element to absolute fitness remains constant, its relative fitness, or cost, if it is lost, is increased. By the way, I'm sorry, the rescaling of... I should have checked the screen size. These things are not sort of scrambled. There are a bunch of genes of a given size, slices, then some ones twice as thick, then some ones twice as thick, then so on. So it's an exponential distribution of genes of different size effects. So smaller changes in population near the water's edge, when the population has drastically reduced fitness, have amplified effects for other elements, even if they're not connected in any other way than that they're all in the same boat. This is the last straw principle. It also shows a kind of diffuse epistasis. Genotypic packaging, organismal selection, entails in yet another way the falsity of the selfish gene perspective. Richard Dawkins has this metaphor of switching rowers between boats to evaluate their fitness in different contexts. The problem is, what this shows, these simulations show, is he ignored the boat. And so the single locus models simply are invalid because of this diffuse epistasis. Here's actually it happening. This is an average of 50 runs of populations of 100 organisms with a genome size of 248 loci. It's an additive system with truncation selection and five fitness classes of equal total contribution. You see, these are stacked bar graphs in the top, and you see the frequency in each of them going down as the fitness total fitness declines. In the bottom graph, the relative frequencies are graphed, and there you can see that after generation 100, that's the first dotted line across, this is 4,000 generations, the top three classes reverses in direction. And what's happened is loss in the lower classes and the lower frequency classes is reducing the total fitness of the of organisms in the population enough to scale up the top classes, so you have trajectory reversal. In effect, then, this graph shows the relevance of the higher level of organization, namely genotypic fitnesses, in the dynamics of the problem. So this is, in effect, a multi-scale model seen from below. Okay. Now, failures of aggregativity lead to emergence and the necessity to construct theories of the phenomena at multiple levels of organization. Multiscale modeling is required for one or both of two reasons. First, because a system has multiple relevant boundaries for its behavior, both inputs and for its effects, at different scales or levels. And second, because it has emergent processes at higher levels whose dynamics must be addressed at that level. Either of these can be a source of a need for multiscale modeling. That is, the lower scale doesn't give you the boundary conditions, so you have to go up a scale to get it, and you get new phenomena and interaction when you go up a scale. Okay. In the example, we just saw a model with purely additive fitnesses, a paradigmatic case for gene-level theories, with the addition of truncation selection and making the additive contributions of different sizes, generated results in the dynamics that clearly indicated the action of genome-level selection. Here a boundary condition emerged that was implicit but not obvious in the model. More generally, dimensions of aggregativity can be used as ways of finding local order and localizing emergent and threshold effects where the conditions fail. But we now see that they must be analyzed dynamically as well as statically. Properties that are wholly aggregative functions or properties at a lower level do not require a multi-scale treatment. But in effect, virtually all properties, or all interesting properties, are emergent in this respect. The only properties I could find, by the way, fit this were things like mass, charge, and so on. And it turned out, of course, they're the subject of the great conservation laws of physics in the 19th century. They said, why? Why are they conserved? Well, because they're aggregative. They're invariant under all these transformations. Okay. If they fail to be aggregative in one dimension, this entails emergence in that respect and the need for nonlinear system-level functions of parts, properties, at the higher level. The presence of multiple and dynamically changing boundary conditions, not special to biological systems. It's characteristic of systems of all kinds. I want to illustrate this with a remarkable phenomenon that I can only sketch an explanation for, and I'm not sure it's right, that I observed at the shore of Lake Michigan near our country house one spring a number of years ago. You see in the foreground, these like they look like cakes. And that's in sand. They have depressed centers, and they're roughly the same size, and so on. So it's quite mysterious how they form. Physicist Leo Kadanoff, to whom I took this puzzle, suggested they started as wave-agitated ice chunks that broke up and took their current shape through agitation and gradually picked up more sand until they stopped. Apparently, left high and dry on the beach as the wave action subsided and the ice melted away. This explains the formation and arrangement of the mound and their depressed centers. So we have here complex boundary conditions, both structural and dynamical, involving wave action and sand, as well as the anomaly that solid water is lighter than liquid water. Ice formation, recurrent gentle water level changes, breaking up the ice into chunks, later allowing layered ice sand buildup on chunks, and gentle wave action, presumably moderated behind the outer sand reefs. You see them out there. Allowing agitation and rounding of chunks, then with change in wind reducing surges and chunks isolated on the solid beach, increasing temperature melts the ice, leaving patterned cells of sand. This narrative suggests that prior formation of the ice sand reef out away from the shore is required to attenuate normal wave action. This involves an enormous number of temporally changing boundary conditions. And this is, in fact, the norm in biology. So this lists all these conditions. And I want to go down to the sand hills in the background. These are 6 to 8 feet tall. They're about 200 feet away. They're erected through wave action against the beach. In effect, the same processes operating with different parameters. They defrost to an underwater sandbar within another week, which persist at least well into the summer, perhaps throughout the whole year. The water's edge emerges about 30 feet from foreground. Now, so for the formation of the outer sand reefs, we have lower temperature, formation of ice, sufficiently strong wave action, draws up sand from the bottom, coating the ice, increasing its weight, causing, in this case, the ice sand chunks to sink, anchoring further runaway buildup of reef as waves crash on the surface and freeze. Notice the reef leaves a sandbar after it melts that persists for most or all of the summer. Question, is a sandbar relevant or crucial in precipitating the initial wave action in the formation process? Can the parameters of the process explain, one, the semi-periodic separation between reef peaks, and two, its distance from the shore? Presumably, yes. The formation of ice reefs, I'd note, commonly occurs each winter. The hexagonal sand piles were observed only once, suggesting particular conditions. Now notice again two kinds of boundary conditions here, both of which are relevant for biology. Structural boundary conditions, e.g. waveguides and the physics of waveguides or edges of ice chunks, versus dynamical boundary conditions, e.g. sinusoidal inputs of a given magnitude, such as periodic wave action. So Bob Batterman has documented how multiple realizability can arise through renormalization. But must multiple realizability arise through this path, the yield leads to renormalization group methods and criticality? I think not. Indeed, the very existence of stable levels of organization and macro phenomena points to massive multiple realizability. And I believe that it can be attained in multiple different ways. Now think about that. Look at the stability we have for all of the objects in this room. If there weren't micro-level multiple realizability, we wouldn't have it. So it's got to be have multiple, it's got to have explanations and probably multiple kinds of explanations. Selection is a stochastic process utilizing mutations that are randomly placed in the genome, utilizing co-options that are good enough, often enough. Forget about optimization. This should produce the opportunistic mode of disorganization characterized earlier as a big ball of mud. How can robustness or multiple realizability possibly emerge in such a structure? Let me emphasize the sort of paradox of this. A generation ago, in the work of George Williams, we were taught that genes were the only thing sufficiently stable to be evolutionary units. And genes show significant epistasis, nonlinear gene interaction with other genes, in complex combinatorial ways. So a change in either genes or environment should change phenotype, which, so the argument goes, must be less stable than either. Since phenotypes are products of genes and environment, and genes are scrambled in sexual recombination, phenotypes should be very unstable. Each one is a product of a new genotype. Wrong. They are. Phenotypes are quite stable. Despite all of the nonlinear gene interactions and new combinations, most offspring phenotypes are not only clearly of the same species as the parent, but reflect their many detailed morphological, behavioral, and biochemical traits. Thus, we may say that a child has her mother's eyes, her father's forehead, and her hair and hair color, and her grandmother's disposition. Young human mothers have roughly 50% viable embryos. How is this possible? Why aren't most new zygotes immediately inviable? Furthermore, if there weren't significant heritability, both of fitness and of the individual characters from parents to offspring, because the environment that makes for fitness because of the characters, evolution would be impossible. We would not be here. This is, in some sense, the deepest paradox of biological organization. Andreas Wagner, in 2005, had a book I strongly recommend to you. It shows that evolution has turned the phenotype for robustness of essential characteristics at multiple levels, from redundant DNA on up, in the face of environmental and genetic variation in all essential properties. But how has it been produced? I don't think there's an argument in all cases, but there is an extremely important subclass of cases. I've argued that since 1987 that sexual recombination is a major driver of robustness in sexual species. Given genetic variability at 5% or more of loci, so that about 1,000 out of 20,000 loci would be segregating for humans, and random recombination of genes in offspring, and widespread epistasis among alleles at different loci, and non-additivity among alleles at the same locus, recombination must act as a strong filter against high epistatic fitness variations among different recombinations. Happily, Livnat, Feldman, and the third author in PNAS in 2008 have since confirmed this claim in simulations, arguing that selection in the presence of sex robustly favors alleles that do well across multiple genetic backgrounds. So this is an instance of the kind of complex stability possible in an open, nonlinear, highly context-dependent, and facultative biological and adaptive systems. I suggest that similar things are true for evolved adaptive systems in general, including complex, context-dependent, and conditional cognitive organism environment artifact multi-agent complexes, or else we couldn't make human culture or other forms of coordinated behavior work. In our elaboration of culture in a biological organization, the operation of scaffolding is a common element, and generative entrenchment, to which I now turn, builds cumulative stable structures. This might be the last thing I can talk about. How much time have I got?
10 minutes.
Oh, okay. We'll see how far I can get. Generative entrenchment. Here we have an evolving adaptive system with a recurring developmental trajectory, a life cycle, and differential entrenchment generating different degrees of evolutionary conservation because modifications of more deeply entrenched things are more likely to fail because more things depend on them and to lead to bigger failures. They're thus more likely to be preserved and to acquire further downstream dependent features which presuppose their presence. Different degrees of entrenchment give the dynamics for differential rates of change and a theory of evolution that needn't mention genes, although I can use entrenchment of genes if we have it. Von Baer's law, dating to 1828, is that earlier stages of diverse organisms are more similar than later ones. To Darwin, this suggested common origins. This early evolutionary conservatism, that is early in development, is explained by the greater downstream dependencies or the generative entrenchment of earlier features. But this is a molecular as well as a morphological process. Cross-phyletic comparisons allow the extraction of the genomic architecture pictured here. This is from Eric Davidson's book on genetic regulatory systems in 2006. It indicates a kernel, which he says is underlying specification in the heart progenitor field. He compares the circuitry in Drosophila at top and invertebrates at the bottom. And they're actually, it's so conserved that it's common among all vertebrates. And extracts elements of the circuitry they have in common, presumably ancestral to both. Note that the conserved elements he talks about are not DNA sequences or even genes. They're not even always the same genes, but rather functional roles played by the genes. Now, notice, incidentally, here we've gone all the way reductionistic and had to move back up to functional organization level. One of several characterizations of self-organization, symmetry breaking, is particularly relevant to generative entrenchment. Generic properties of interest emerge or self-organize through self-amplifying deviations from conditions of homogeneity or symmetry. So examples of pattern formation, like the famous Belousov-Jabotinsky reagent, in which spiral-colored patterns of activity emerge from local density fluctuations in the reactants and expand to cover and entrain the whole system. The emergence of differential entrenchment in complex systems is such a process. So consider a system, say a gene control network like those played with in the prior simulation I discussed, in which all of its elements are equally strongly selective or have equivalent amounts of generative entrenchment or downstream dependency. This homogeneity is unlikely for any differentiated system whose parts would have different conditions and consequences of failure. It would be an engineering system. And all interesting mechanisms are made of differentiated parts. This was in part the motivation for constructing the multi-locus truncation selection model with different size fitness contribution discussed above. The fixation of the more strongly selected loci was demonstrating the stability of more entrenched elements under mutation and selection. Now, suppose mutations add new downstream elements to this circuit in which we're imagining that every element makes a contribution of equal size, depending on one or more, but not all of the existing elements. Any such mutation would increase the generative entrenchment of those elements that it depends upon. But then their loss through other mutations would be more strongly selected against. Thus, their expected lifetime in a system evolving under a selection mutation balance and their chance of acquiring still more entrenching mutations would both be increased. This is a symmetry breaking process favoring differential generative entrenchment. So notice we utilize some of the conceptual tools from condensed matter physics, but in a different way to argue that it can apply to this to generative entrenchment. So not only is differential generative entrenchment characteristic of any differentiated system, but it also would emerge from symmetry-breaking transitions in any system that did not already show it. It's thus robustly generic and a fundamental architectural feature in evolving systems. Both contingent elements and generic ones can become entrenched. They just must be stable for long enough to acquire further dependencies. And this gives them greater chance of surviving to acquire still more. Stable systems are properties that are natural targets for entrenchment. Thus, both already entrenched things and generic properties can become themselves further entrenched and become foundational elements. When an entrenched element that is not generic becomes foundational, it constitutes a contingent order that has broad effects. These are exceedingly common in biological systems, but also in human technologies and institutions. All of these can form boundary conditions for further evolution of complex systems. By the way, entrenchment is why history matters in biological systems, because the conservation gives you a kind of architecture that also applies functionally, and you can understand the physiology, and you can get comparative information about different organisms. However, there's an important additional source of information for the study of adaptations in both biology and culture. The layered complexity, both in evolution and technology, layered through the conservative tendencies of generative entrenchment, operating in both areas, makes the study of the history an essential source of insight. So I'll say a little about levels and then I'll stop. Levels have been characterized compositionally, but that does nothing to explain why they occur at the particular scales that they do. They have also, by Craver and Bechtel, been characterized in terms of mechanism and their parts. And this is of substantial local usefulness, but it also does not capture the broad patterns of order that occur in nature. I've chosen to capture the levels in Plato's terms of cutting nature at its joints. Suppose a massive phase space embracing all possible modes of organization of matter. Then levels would be local maxima of regularity and predictability, where you can get the biggest bang for a buck in constructing theory. I argued that levels would be characterized in terms of richly interacting, robust objects, which because they're robust, they're hooked into other things multiply, and that they would levels themselves would be robust. So, but why do levels of organization occur where they do? I think this is largely an unsolved question, and I'd love to see people thinking about it more. In fact, it's largely an unasked question among philosophers. presumably because of the relative dominance of different physical forces in assembling or affecting entities of different size scales. So to a water flea, surface tension matters, but gravity is negligible. While to an elephant, surface tension is irrelevant, but gravity is a major constraint in activity. Gravity affects waterborne, terrestrial, and airborne locomotion differently, producing successively greater strength and energetic requirements for movements in the three media. Surface-to-volume ratios for metabolic exchange processes affect each of these differently. Elegant examples of these problems in the life of a bacterium are discussed in physicist E.M. Purcell's classic Life at Low Reynolds Number, where Brownian motion is important and the problem of generating irreversible motion for a bacterium so that it can actively go somewhere are substantial. This is a cartoon of levels of organization. I've picked representative things of on different scales. Imagine we have a size scale on the horizontal axis and degree of regularity and predictability that emerges at that size scale on the vertical axis. And the argument here is that because with more degrees of freedom and more ways of interacting with things at neighboring levels, as you get more and more complex, higher levels tend to spill over more and more, and the regularities we expect at higher levels are less crisp than they are at lower levels. So I'm not going to say much about that, but so levels of organization have imprecise size boundaries. So a water molecule is smaller than a uranium atom. And this becomes increasingly pronounced at higher levels of organization. So cells can differ in dimension by three orders of magnitude. This is because larger systems, the greater number of degrees of freedom, gives greater possibilities for interaction with entities at different levels. I think this may be the last slide, or I'll skip to the very end. Levels of organization are robust sources of order, and thus attractors in the evolution of other entities which should evolve in such a way as to minimize the uncertainty in their environment. This is a claim made by Richard Levins. But organisms also need to make themselves as unpredictable as possible for their predators. I want to suggest that this tension between predictability and unpredictability in evolution is responsible for the increasing sensitivity of sensory systems. We've got basically an arms race between predator and predatee. Increasing sensitivity of sensory systems and much of the dynamical complexity and I'd say possible chaotic behavior in biological systems. So, for example, J.R. Platt observed that boundaries tend to accumulate or generate other coincidental boundaries, a form of self-organization using pre-existing order. So there's relevant organizational information not organized by level or size. I just show this picture. These are various different ways of decomposing a fly according to your interest into genetic subsystems, anatomy, physiology, and the like, and the complexities that arise that I wrote about a long time ago when you have to try to put all those things together. One consequence of this view is that articulating different causal perspectives at a low level, say anatomy at the level of cellular ultrastructure with physiology at the level of biochemical pathways, by noting that particular biochemical reactions take place at specific places in the cell does not finish the job. It does not, as traditional reductionism might have supposed, automatically zip anatomy and physiology together all the way up. This could be true only if all higher level properties were aggregative. Rather, in constructing explanations of behavior, each pair of links must be laboriously articulated together with forces, factories, and structural and dynamical boundary conditions acting at that level. So we can see multiple cases requiring multi-scale modeling in biology as well as in physics. In addition, we see that biology has some generic self-organizing processes that physics lacks in the production of robustness through recombination processes and sexual reproduction, and in symmetry breaking processes favoring differential generative others and generative entrenchment. I suspect there are others, but of course we don't know. Thank you.